Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card. The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Thank you so much to all of the supporters of the show. Before I do the shout outs for this month, I do want to thank everyone who has let me know again how much this podcast has meant to them. And I also want to do a shout out to my team, to Rob and Ariana, who are wonderful and who helped to make this really run as seamlessly as possible. And now, to the people who have given $10 or more per month, again, to help this stay on the air, to Joseph, Catherine, Kit Casey, Lynn, Julia, Tremian, Elizabeth, Sheila, Holly, Tammy, David, Apostababe, Donna, Jessica, Mislav, Michael, Zofia, Kathy, Audrey, Alex, Ken, Katrina, Sarah, Christina, Ludwig, Scott, Brianna, Peter and Cynthia, Linda, Jolie, Camus, Lillian, and Maureen. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And also, please let me know if I did not pronounce your name correctly. It's important to me that I do, so just give me a hint. If I need to pronounce it in a different way, I want to give you the utmost of respect. And thank you for everyone who has supported this show. And if you would like to do so, it is most needed and truly necessary to keep this going. So please go to patreon.com/indoctrination to become a supporter of the show for any amount you can. patreon.com/indoctrination. Hi, everyone. Today we have something a little different for you. We have what's called a crossover episode. I'm going to be sharing with you an episode that I did, actually, on someone else's show. And it's a show called Shrink Chicks. And it's hosted by Jennifer Chaikin and Emily Beerley. They are both licensed marriage and family therapists. And I was on their show in December of 2020, talking about the psychology of cults. I thought you might be interested in hearing the questions that they asked me, and also because I share a little bit more about not only the psychology of cults, but a little bit about myself as a way of getting to know what prompted me to get into this field and what it's like to do this work. You can find their show on all platforms where you find your podcasts. Definitely check out their show. They have great episodes about many different subjects. I hope you enjoy the episode today, and the outro, the one more thing before you go, will not be happening today because we're doing things a little differently. But stay tuned anyway, because we're going to have a little announcement after this crossover show. So welcome to a combo of the Indoctrination Podcast with Shrink Chicks.
Welcome, Rachel. Thank you so much for being here. We're so excited.
I am so happy to be here. And I do love to speak to fellow therapists. There aren't so many of us in this particular area of specialization, so I don't actually get a chance to hang out with a lot of different therapists, especially people with the same license. And I also love the name of your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We worked really hard on it. We needed something a little catchy. but it's especially we were really excited to bring you on because we both watched the documentary, and you're right that there aren't a lot of therapists who specialize, from what we hear, in cults. And so we just
it definitely wasn't part of our grad school education.
Right. Like that wasn't an option for us.
Right.
Yeah. There was no cult track. There was only sex therapy and family therapy. So we would love to hear a little bit more about your journey working with some of these survivors.
Right. Okay. So it's an interesting thing because exactly as you said, there was nothing in school. There was no track. Yeah, still it's rare to find it. There's a program I know run by friends and colleagues of mine in England, which is lovely. But I also know that it needs to be available in so many more places because there is definitely more of a need for this kind of therapy than there are therapists who can provide this kind of service. And now, especially that there are not only people who have gotten involved in cults as adults, but because they've been around for a long time, they're now second generation, third generation, fourth generation people who are out there needing help and not able to find it. So I encourage people to look into kind of figuring out how to do this work. I was sort of flying by the seat of my pants when I first got started, because the only books out there at the time were written by cult leaders who thought they had something really wonderful to say. But that didn't really help me in this work. So I was like, yes, they're narcissists. I knew that, you know? So I don't know how that's, you know, useful. But I think, so much of what really prompted me to get into this was having a family member when I was in high school, having a family member who got involved in a cultic group, and we could see a sudden personality change and distrust of the family suddenly and false accusations about us. And, you know, all of the stuff that cults do where they try to rewrite your history and make it so you should feel lucky to have found them so they can keep you safe from the world outside and everyone in it. It was very alarming. So when I went to college, and I then by then learned about some cults and cults that exist on college campuses and under front names, I saw it. I saw it on my college campus. I thought, wow, this is real. And then when I went to grad school to become a therapist, I was at USC. And I remember being in a program, in a class where they talked about what would you provide your clients beyond the talking therapy? You know, would you get them involved in some adjunct kind of program, self-help group that might help them? And people were saying, yes, you know, I had gone to this and this was really helpful, but I knew this, the thing they were mentioning, was kind of destructive and took over your life. And I thought, wow, that's all people need to finally go to a therapist and have their therapist, you know, refer them to a cult. So I thought, all right, that's it. I have to do this. I have to figure out how. I have to learn. And I just decided that while I was going to meet with regular clients, and I still do, about 20% of my clients probably know nothing about this part of my life and the work that I do, because I just see them for, you know, whatever it is, sort of typical things. But as soon as I said, you know, yeah, I want to be out there helping people who have been involved in cults and trying to guide their families to interact with them, suddenly my clientele, they just kind of flocked in. And it's now consistently been about 80% of the work that I do.
Wow.
When you bring up this interesting point that we sometimes forget is like the power we have as clinicians, that if mm-hmm. we make a suggestion, how much weight that carries.
Yes.
And how incredibly dangerous that could be.
Yes. Right. And, you know, hopefully we'll have time to even talk about this, which is a very trippy thing. I have worked with a number of people who got out of relationships with therapists, with their own therapists, where the therapist took over their lives.
Oh my God.
And became their cult leader. And, and I run a former cult member support group every other Wednesday night. Now it's online. But someone in the support group talked about her fear of coming back into a therapeutic setting and also a group setting, because if you didn't make a commitment to come to every group, which was a few times a week in her group, you were talked about, you were defamed, you were shamed. You're not making a commitment to this work, et cetera. It's very culty. And you couldn't make one decision in your life without the therapist giving you permission or telling you what decision you should make. And so it was, it's very scary for a lot of people out there to go back into a therapeutic setting once they've been in a therapy cult. And there are those.
Wow. Yeah. Like the, you know, NXIVM, for example, you know, it looked like it brought a lot of people in with the kind of self-help aspect. And it's, you know, just as you're talking about that, it's so interesting, like that the way in which to heal, right? I mean, as we talk about is like going to therapy, and how, like, does that ever feel re-traumatizing for them going back into therapy or self-help in some way with that kind of fear?
Yeah, it's re-traumatizing. I give them so much credit for taking that risk, for saying, you know, at some point, I'm not going to let this bad, quote unquote, therapeutic or really non-therapeutic experience affect my ability to get the help that I need now. But it takes some time. People, you know, it can take them years to feel safe to embark on this. And sometimes they wait until they know someone else has seen someone else who has left the same group, has met with a therapist and had a good, safe experience or kind of a corrective and healing experience, then they'll come to see you. But yeah, there is a real fear that somebody is going to be in that position of authority, who they're going to trust, who is going to abuse that trust. And that also they are not going to be able to remain independent from that person's control and have their own thoughts and, or be able to disagree, be able to stop when they want to, you know, that they're going to give over a sense of agency. They're going to give over their independence as soon as they're in that therapeutic relationship, because that's what happened before. And they don't yet know what to watch out for. So what I start by doing is telling them what to watch out for. And I will tell them, if you see that happening, or if you worry about that happening with me, tell me, or leave, please leave.
Like, yes. It's true.
Yeah. No. Right. The door's open. And especially on Zoom, just turn off the computer. Just
close the computer.
Well, but
right.
I mean, the reason that most of us show up to therapy, show up to some type of self-help thing, is we're looking for identity. Right. And it's the very thing that people lose in a high controlled situation, and how much influence we have as therapists in helping people discover and sometimes shape their identity, and how when someone has lost their identity, they can make anyone into a guru, right? Like this idea of like how much power we have as clinicians. There's lots of times we make mistakes. We say wrong things all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's important for our clients to hold us accountable for that.
Yes, right, exactly. And so I'll tell you, I'll tell you a little story. When I was first, doing this work, I was working at a place in Los Angeles that had been in existence. Unfortunately, it's not anymore. Through actually Scientology pressuring the agency to close it's a long story, but Scientology has closed a lot of places through threats that could be resources to people out there, unfortunately. But in any event, I was working at this place while it still existed. It was called the Cult Clinic. It was in Los Angeles. It was part of Jewish Family Service. And I was asked to run a former cult member support group. And it was actually quite big. In fact, there were some current Scientologists who wanted to get into the group, saying they were former Jews or former something else. And so they could be in this former cult member support group. And I said, no. And then they tried to bring me up on charges of religious persecution. And that's why I wouldn't let them in. They just, you know, they've been in my hair this 30 years. Wow. But in any event, here I was. The ink was basically still drying on my license. I kind of didn't know what I was doing yet. Like a lot of us have this sort of imposter syndrome, which I think shows some humility when we first start this work, where we're thinking, why did you come to me? Like, I don't know how to help you. But give me a couple years, you know? So I think it was hard because here I had this group of former cult members who were nervous, who were asking me questions like, is it okay if we get up and we leave? Are we going to be talked about when we leave? Are we going to have to wait to, again, make any decision in our life until you give us permission? No, no, no. But after the first group, I remember going back to where I lived at the time and thinking, wow, it's really funny to think about it. I thought, I'm really good at this. I mean, here they were all agreeing with me. And they thought that what I was saying was really wise. And then suddenly it hit me. And then, oh, right. Okay, got it. So then I had been guru-fied and I didn't realize it. And so I had to go back the next time and say, listen, you know, here's a little tip. You can disagree with me. I can be wrong. I can handle that. And in fact, I want you to tell me when I've said something that doesn't seem like it fits. And I want you to try that. And I could see the look of panic on their faces. Wow. And I said, okay, then let's try it in a way that's not emotionally charged. I'm going to say to you, I really like your red shirt, but I knew the shirt was blue. So how can you let me know that I'm wrong? And they said, but we couldn't do that. We couldn't say, you know, without threat of consequence that even, you know, no, actually the shirt is blue. So we had to practice kind of role playing that because there was real fear, because if you kind of, for lack of a better clinical term, pissed off the leader and hurt their, you know, kind of fragile narcissistic core, you would be publicly shamed or berated for hours and hours and hours.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like a lot of the work that happens, and we talk about this all the time, that, you know, the relationship between the client and their therapist, that's part of the work, right? And so it sounds like a lot of the work would come from kind of your relationship with the client in the room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. And something now it's a little moot because things are online, but something that I have decided to do, which is very purposeful, and I don't know how necessary it is, but it makes me feel comfortable, is that I arrange my office in a visual way to send a message. I have actually measured the height of my chair and the height of the other chairs and the couches in the room to make sure no one is higher than anyone else. And I'm definitely not higher than them. Yeah. I don't want them to feel like they have to, like, I see myself as sitting on this throne as they've experienced before. And I want us to, in a very literal sense, be seeing eye to eye. And so for some, most people don't notice it, but I think they might feel something, and other people have actually noticed it. Like, oh, it's nice that actually we're looking at each other. I'm not looking up to you and you're not looking down at me.
Wow.
And I think also yes, the relationship is a really important one, especially because a lot of people, by the time they get to me, have usually seen other therapists who either couldn't help them, hadn't studied this, didn't have an interest, or kept telling them these things just didn't happen. They, you know, they're probably delusional that they were in a group where they thought the mothership was coming, but actually that did happen, because when you learn about that group, that is, that was the philosophy. So the person isn't delusional. And I think, you know, other people have had the experience of trying to talk about it, but because it's not within the therapist's wheelhouse, they keep changing it. They keep changing the subject. Well, let's talk about your childhood, or let's talk about your mother. And it's been avoided, actively avoided. And so I think that they're really wanting help, and they're not wanting to have to keep waiting to get it.
And it makes it, you know, it makes a ton of sense. And I think as we, you know, as we talk about it, and once again, as we watch the documentary, we kind of learn a little bit how, you know, people get pulled into it. And so I, you know, just want to hear from your perspective, because I think it's so easy for people on the outside to kind of look at members of cults and think, like, how didn't they see that this was manipulation? Or how could they agree to certain things within the cult? And so can you touch a little bit on, like, how kind of that process, like what draws people in and how they might not be able to see what's happening?
Yeah, so it's a multi-layered kind of issue. So what draws people in is a kind of a multitude of things. As I've talked about with a lot of my clients who will often judge themselves, you know, what's wrong with me that I didn't see this? I didn't see it for what it was. What's wrong with me that I trusted the wrong person? What's wrong with me that even after I started noticing things that I'm not happy about, or that I knew were wrong, that I still stayed. So these are all things that, you know, need to kind of be understood, and we will talk that through. And so just as I talk to them about it, I'll try to take you kind of through those steps, how I help the people I work with understand what their process was. But what draws people in usually is some kind of false promise, or an opportunity that the group says it's going to be able to provide for you. With Nexium, people weren't getting into this thing that's now called a sex cult. In fact, most of the people weren't having sex there at all. And that's why it's a shame that it, that moniker the media has given it is shaming. But most people got in because of this ESP, the Executive Success Programs. Which I think it purposely was actually called ESP. But still, they wanted to have success in their lives or get over the things that were blocking them from having success. And a lot of them had good business acumen and wanted to keep working on that. And it was, so it was very innocent. And it's what a lot of people are looking for, especially when things are hard financially, people are looking to create more success for themselves. And other people are looking for something spiritual. They have gone through recently a hard time where they've dealt with some issues around health or getting a brush with their mortality, and they want to know if there's a life after. And so there's a group out there that will answer that question for you. You know, sometimes people get involved not so much because of who they are, but when they were recruited or when they saw the ad for that group and it really spoke to them then. And sometimes people are just looking for community, because a cult, even though there are some one-on-one cults, most cults will give you Insta community. And these are all people who are like me, and we also speak the same language, because cults have their own lingo, and that means sort of we understand each other. And so that feels really nice. It pierces isolation, which a lot of people are experiencing now. And that's unfortunately why cults are doing so well right now. You know, so that's the draw for a lot of people. The people who get in later, not the ones who were born and raised into it. The draw for them isn't any, actually. It's not what they chose at all. It was just kind of inflicted on them. But once you get involved, you are made to keep your blinders on. If you have any negative thoughts, if you're angry about anything happening there, if you're sad about it, if you think that it's wrong, immediately you are taught to criticize yourself for having those thoughts.
Mm.
And that's the devil in some, you know, Bible-based groups. That's your negative thinking. That's the thing that's going to get in your way. That's your emotional blockage. We can help you with that. So you really think that whenever you're taking in kind of the evidence of your senses, which usually kind of guided you in a good way and let you know there was danger here. Well, within a cult, they will tell you when you have that experience or that reaction, that just proves how much more you need them because you're having those thoughts. It's very trippy, right from the start.
You're like taught not to trust yourself in a lot of ways.
Right. And that's very debilitating when people get out because they hang on to that. They're taught and not to trust themselves and still don't trust themselves for quite some time after they leave.
Wow.
So for you, someone who has worked so much, I'm so interested to know, do you think people like, we'll call it whether it's a Keith Raniere or any other cult leader, do you think their goal is to start a cult or do you think it evolves over time and they're like, oh crap, look what I could do here?
Right. So it's a great question because I've seen a couple of different ways that cults have started. With some, you know, and I've met a couple cult leaders, which has been really interesting. And so you get a sense of them and what kind of what they're up to or if they're up to something or not to a certain degree. Okay. So there are kind of three different cult leaders, kind of the types, prototypes that I've noticed. One is this kind of very innocent person who really has some kind of pathology, who really believes that either that they have a magical power or that they can commune with people or ancient spirits or whatever else, and they hear them talking to them, and people jump in to that kind of group and that group think and that philosophy or that theology as kind of a folie à deux, right? A shared psychosis. And so that doesn't mean that those groups end up in being fine just because it's more innocent, because you still have groups like Heaven's Gate, like in San Diego, where that was the case, but they ended up killing themselves to go to the mothership, which is the reference that I used before. So you still want to watch those groups for danger, but the cult leader isn't trying to start a cult. They're saying, here, this is what I think is true. You know, who wants to join me in this? Because I want to share this important information with you. Then you have the people who start out kind of just wanting to be street preachers or teach a class or run a yoga studio or whatever else. But they find about themselves that people happen to listen to everything they say. And they feel like Pied Pipers, and they suddenly have a sense of their charisma, and they're kind of fascinated by it, but also really drawn into it and start to like it way too much and start to use it. And those are the ones who morph over time and become kind of more drunk with their power. And the more that happens, then the more cult-like their group becomes. Mm-hmm. And so they transform the group from something innocent to something not innocent at all. Then most of the cult leaders are starting a cult and they know what they're doing. They've studied it. You'll find, you know, on their bookshelves and now probably just on the internet, but they've studied other people who have run cults. They study totalistic leaders. They study people who have done hypnosis on large groups of people and how they did it, how they drew people in and lowered their defenses. And so they know what they're doing from start to finish. And those are the ones who are, in my book, totally reprehensible. Those are the Keith Raniere's of this world.
Wow.
Wow.
We did an episode a few weeks ago about narcissistic personality disorder. And I think it's just so, I don't know what the word is, like fascinating that like there are people who know what they're doing and that they hurt other people knowing that they're hurting other people.
Well, and they get a satisfaction from it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yes. It's chilling.
It's chilling. Yes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like hanging out with someone at a party and then you realize afterwards they're a serial killer, right? You're thinking, yeah. You know, you want to take a shower. You were so close to just sickness and awfulness and you didn't know, you know, because they were charming. So that's how a lot of people feel now who have left groups like NAXIOM and other groups like it, where they think, you know, I sat and hung out in a room with someone who was doing some horrible things and also was intending to do even more horrible things, but seemed so benign and lovely and had this nice smile and seemed to care. And so I didn't notice the evil under the skin. And it is really awful for a lot of people who realize that after. But yeah, you know, narcissists, the malignant narcissists who I come across a lot in this field, they really love inflicting pain. They love pulling people away from their lives. They love causing their families and friends pain by making them make kind of a show of allegiance to them by saying goodbye to their family and friends or accusing their parents of abuse. So it's easier than, or convincing them that the parents have abused them. So it's easier to say goodbye to them. Yeah. What I think we've noticed in a lot of these groups is that some of these leaders love when they can get people within the group to inflict pain on each other.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other level of disgusting behavior because they like the power of seeing if they can get someone to do something that would typically be against their moral and ethical code that is outside their conscience. And how do you get someone to do that? You usually will get someone to do that by feeling like that's a way for them to show that how much they're devoted to you and how much they want this to work. And this is, you convince them this is the only way all this hard work and devotion they put into this is actually gonna work by showing that they're able and capable and strong enough to do this. That's one, to show allegiance and to show bravery. And the other way they usually get people to do this is by convincing them that this is going to be for the other person's benefit. And this is going to help them grow and be stronger in some way. But unfortunately, you have these lovely people who leave these groups and feel so much shame and so much worry about themselves that they were able to be pushed to do these awful things or to let awful things happen to other people. And they knew that was happening and they didn't do anything to stop it because they were kept from being able to stop it.
Well, so I'm interested to know, like, you know, if someone had come to you and said, how do I know, right? How do I recognize emotional manipulation and abuse? There's people that are concerned. And I think people can, whether it's with their therapist, right? Like, well, my therapist says they care about me and I pay them to see them and I see them every week and they know all this stuff about me. How would I know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So when I am working with people, I can sometimes tell and sometimes not right away that they have been involved in a cult or they've been taken over in a certain way. A lot of cult members have an outward persona that's a very practiced persona where they come across like they're fine. They've learned to be fine to the outside world. The cult leader will usually push people to seem fine because they want to keep getting away with what they're getting away with. And so if the people in the cult look awful and look bedraggled and worn out and that clearly they've been abused or neglected, then that's going to make people be suspicious of the cult. So they have a very kind of strong, everything's fine, kind of outward way of approaching people. And so sometimes you don't find out right away that someone has been through something. It's only until they feel safe sharing that part of themselves that you'll start to see that they're actually very jumpy and kind of panicky, very worried about how you feel about them, very worried that you're upset about something that they did and you have no idea what it even is, only because you're not wired in the same way that a narcissist is. So you're not injured by the same things and you're not as sensitized to the same sorts of things. So when I notice a client will call me or email me in between sessions and apologize for something, I will have a sense of it. Wow. They're just really, really worried and they want to make sure I still like them. And when I say, I don't remember what happened, they will at first see that as a test, which also is a sign that I'm not believing them right away. And they still have to work harder to apologize harder, which is usually what a cult leader will do. And if I say, I honestly don't know what you are referring to, or I do know what you're referring to, and there was no problem with it at all, not to worry. They will sometimes still cancel their next appointment because they can't deal with what they're sure is going to happen to them when they come to see me. There are sort of these markers. I've also noticed people will sometimes, if they come to the group when I had them in my office, if people show up late, which was never allowed in cults or in therapy cults especially, and you'd be berated for it, I will sometimes see my call light going on a couple minutes after the group starts, and then it will go off. Like the person is not sure that they're ready to let me know they're there, but that they arrived late. And then I'll see it go on again, like they're thinking they can trust, and it goes off. And that's how I know, you know, it gives me a sense of what they've been through. And I think also when people don't feel deserving, they leave really taking on the sense that the reason that they, let's say, left the group or were kicked out is because they're not worthy of being there. They have abandoned the mission. They let down the leader. They let down the world. You know, all these things that are used to kind of keep people in. And so you'll see them doing a lot of self-sabotage because they really don't feel worthy at all of anything good. So again, there are many things to look for, but these are the things that I notice most often.
Wow. I mean, my mouth is wide open, like while you're talking, because it just sounds like such, like you almost have to really help them rebuild themselves and trust themselves. And it's just got to be a lot of like deep emotional work that goes into that. And also building trust in you and being able to open up and, you know, because I think a lot of the work that we do is helping people to connect with who they are, be their authentic selves, feel like they can be genuine and comfortable with who they are. And it sounds like in a cult, it almost, you know, very specifically creates this distance between what a person is portraying on the outside and what they're feeling inside, and not to trust those internal feelings. So it just sounds like a lot of work to do, you know?
Right. There, you know, years ago, there had been a woman who, I think if people want to learn about kind of the early days of learning about cults, you can study her. She passed away a number of years ago. She was wonderful. Her name is Dr. Margaret Singer, and she was a professor at Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And she studied a lot about manipulation and coercion. She studied POW camps and where people were controlled en masse. And she one time was speaking at a conference and she dealt with a lot of harassment actually by a lot of groups, by Scientology and other groups. And she was great at just kind of being really fierce. And it was hilarious to see her because she had these glasses and she had this gray hair and kind of a bob, and she was just wearing kind of tattered sweaters and looked like she should probably be knitting and not like, you know, you know, standing at the door with a shotgun, you know. So no one would ever know that she was someone who, you know, had spoken before Congress and had done really some amazing thing. So this, Dr. Margaret Singer has this wonderful quote that I think about a lot, which is that when you are in a cultic system or a cultic relationship, which we can talk about, you learn to deny the evidence of your senses. And it is highly disorienting. Mm. So you ignore the thoughts in your mind because these are thoughts that are not of the same caliber as the cult leader, or you learn to, and so, you know, you'll dismiss your thoughts and wait to find out what you're supposed to be thinking. You will ignore the sensations in your body, being incredibly tired, being sick. Doesn't matter if you're sick in a cult. You still have to work. You still have to be showing your devotion. If you're feeling hungry because you just haven't eaten, well, that's a spiritual hunger. And so you need to fast for longer to show that you can get past that. But I think the hardest part is that you're also supposed to ignore all of your emotions in general. So if, again, something happens where a boundary is crossed, where something happens to you that really shouldn't be happening, you are not to be angry about it. You're not to be upset. You're not to be hurt. You are supposed to be fine or grateful. And that makes people really dissociate from themselves. And then coming out of a cult, they have to find a way to kind of merge themselves back and reconnect with their core. And that takes some doing.
I can imagine. Yeah, I can imagine that taking, especially because that's like the pinnacle of, you know, getting people to follow this, is to disconnect or to not trust themselves in a lot of ways. And I know that earlier you said you had a family member who was in a cult and you recognized that their personality was changing. And, you know, I know we talk a lot about other people needing to come to conclusions on their own, and that we, you know, can't see a future for someone that they can't see themselves. And so what would you suggest to someone who might have a family member or friend who is involved in a cult, or they see is involved in a cult? Like, how do they get through to that person? What's your experience with that?
Yeah, so I think there's a way to do it that is counterintuitive. So that's why it's good to get some guidance on this. A lot of family members, parents have responded in a way that was a very natural way to respond, but it's a way that parents and friends fall into a trap that's been set by the cult, and which I'll explain. So when you realize that someone is involved in something, or you find out that all the different changes that they're going through have to do with either someone they're dating who has taken over their lives, taken over their minds, or that they're involved in a group that's taken them over and has changed the way they talk, the way they think, what they believe, how they look, how they dress, whatever else, who they trust, who they don't trust. And of course, only the people in the group and the leader are the people they trust anymore. People will usually say, I think you're in a cult, and or this is really scaring us and you need to stop doing this and we need to somehow find a way to keep you away. And so that is the very, again, natural response, but that's also falling into a trap. So the cult has usually from the beginning taught people that the world is very black and white. And so the people who are in support of you will be the people, and the people who love you are the people who will support you doing this. People who, even if it hurts them and even if it pulls you away from them, they will understand why you're doing this and be fine with it. And if they're not, they don't love you. And if they're not, they haven't really taken the time to understand you. And if they're not okay, they are being selfish. They're trying to control you. They're the controllers. They're the ones who are abusing you and keeping you from having the life and the freedom that you could be having. Now, of course, we know how, you know, there that line with people jumping in to try to protect you, that a cult leader will say that, well, those are the people trying to control you. I mean, it's dripping with irony. Right. And so a lot of people will say, you know, to their parents, they've learned to say certain things like, you just can't support my ability to make choices for myself or my free will. And again, an ironic statement, because once you get involved in a cult, you actually forfeit your free will. And the problem is that parents, they're also often ostracized and judged. And for if they say that their child has gotten involved in the cult, that will usually be seen as a mark of their parenting, which is a very unfortunate thing. So just as it's an isolating thing for people who have left cults, it's very isolating for the family and friends of people who are in cults, because immediately they're judged. And it's awful. But I think what family and friends should do that's different is that they need to not give their opinion of the group, to not be the ones who are trying to keep their loved ones from getting further involved or going there. They need to know a couple things. As soon as they say, you're in a cult and you can't come back, they are going into kind of the camp, the evil camp, the people who are trying to keep you from having your you know, your wonderful life or your insights or whatever the group is offering you. And so now they're the ones who, according to that equation, no longer care about you or love you. Parents also will need to be able to do something which is very hard, which is that they need to be able to just sit and listen. They need to listen to their loved one and just have them teach them about what they like about it, what they like about this group. But parents and loved ones need to remember that they have access to information about a particular group in a way that their loved one who's in it doesn't. People who get involved in cultic groups are kept from the information they need in order to make a fully educated decision. Cults, one of the markers of a cult is that it dictates how much access you have to information. So you are not to check out any articles that have been written about the group. You're not to talk to people who have left. You actually, when you're in a cult, you know the least amount of information about it than anyone else. So here, for parents, to have their child come and talk to them and teach them about what they know, the parents will know that they have the backstory and they know much more about this group than their child does or their loved one. But just they want to be able to have a conversation that is as stress-free as possible, where there's no arguing, where there's no disagreeing, where there's just listening. And in that way, they don't fall into any trap. They remain safe people to talk to, and because there's no tension. And there's also an important thing that happens in that moment where you show an interest in what your child is interested in. And you also learn what this, why this speaks to them, why they're interested in this. So just do a lot of listening. And then after a while, what you want to do as a loved one and a parent is you want to connect with other parents who are in this situation, fellow loved ones, and there are many. So you're not alone and you won't be judged. People will understand. And then parents need to be able to start changing the conversation. And so that's something that I will often guide parents to do, where they will say, listen, you know, I was really thinking that this was a cult, but I could be wrong because, you know, what I've learned is, well, here's the definition of a cult. And so I'm really happy after they delineate all the different characteristics. I'm really happy that's not what you're involved in. Now, the list is something that absolutely fits the group that they're in and absolutely describes everything that's happening there. But they give their loved one an out where they don't have to feel criticized. The parent can be wrong. And what you want in that moment is for there to be some cult education. And then for that loved one to go back to that next meeting or that workshop or the compound and see it for themselves. And once people start to see it for themselves, it's much easier for them to kind of disengage and disentangle because they don't feel they're being pulled out. So they're not going to kind of dig their heels in and need to somehow prove, oh, no, this is fine. This is fine. I think a lot of what I do for parents and loved ones too is to have them talk to their loved one as much as they can and keep communication open by saying, you know, you deserve to be treated in the following ways: with respect, with having a voice, with having a say, with having your goals supported. And you seem so happy in this group. You know, it might be that really here your goals are supported, then people love you for who you really are. That is not something that ever happens in cults, that people are respected for who they are and loved for who they are. But again, what a parent isn't doing is they aren't saying, you know, this cult leader doesn't care at all about you, and this is a cult, and you know, how come you haven't seen it for yourself? And we can see it, and didn't we raise you to be someone who, you know, could tell if you're being manipulated, and these people are awful, because that's just going to push your loved one, especially a child,
right,
further in. And so if you just highlight how you are really hoping they're being treated, because that's how they deserve to be treated because of how great they are and wonderful they are, again, you're doing a really kind of showing them actually what they're not getting, mm-hmm, in the cult. And also what they are getting that is really wrong. And so it's planting seeds. Yeah. It's not pushing and pulling and fighting, arguing, disagreeing. It's just planting seeds. And you hope that they germinate. And if they don't, and time is passing and you think they're in a dangerous situation, then you start working on an intervention if you can. And that's the next thing. But I think these mini interventions are the first line of defense. That's where you start.
That's amazing. Rachel, that's unbelievable advice. And also helpful advice that I think can be brought into a lot of stuff when we talk about people, right?
Right, like relationships.
Well, yes, if they're in an unhealthy relationship, if they're in an unhealthy relationship with substance, right? Like, of how to not attack someone and how to meet them where they're at and try to listen and create that safety for you to be a place. I mean,
right. It's so interesting you said that, because just the other day, someone was saying to me, you know, I am fine with, she was taking some pills for a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And she said, it doesn't control me. I control it. And I said, that's really great. And I used some of these similar things. And I said, because if actually you were having an issue with addiction, there would be no shame in it. Because it happens, it just means that chemically you are being kind of triggered inside your system, which has nothing to do with, you know, your ability in this life and your strength and the kind of person you are. We're just talking chemicals. And also, if it were something that were taking control of your life, then you would probably feel like you couldn't make it through the day without it, or you couldn't show up to whoever's house without being on it. Or that you would imagine if you didn't have it on you in your wallet or your purse that you would start panicking. But, you know, it sounds like, you know, those things aren't happening. And they are.
Right.
But if they are happening, then you might just want to look at it differently and see what you can do about it so that it doesn't make you feel dependent on it, because I would hate for it to have that power over you. So here's the info, take it or leave it. Hope you take it. But decide for yourself.
That's amazing. All right, Rachel, we have one final question for you.
Yeah.
Are you ready? Drum roll. Okay. Most of us, when we're becoming therapists, it's because we want to help people. We want to do research, or we want to teach a class, or, you know, we just want to sit in a room with someone. It, things become a little different when you start to get noticed, right? You're also taking on something that could in some ways make you a target, right? Going against cults, speaking out, helping people. So I'm wondering for you, what was it like being featured on this Seduced documentary in sort of this high profile way that put your name out there?
Okay. So it's an interesting thing because I've been on shows. I've done media. I mean, this is kind of before Netflix and Stars and other shows that I've been on, but I'm always amazed by how I think something is a big deal, like a big deal in my life. Like, wow, this is cool. And friends and some family are, you know, letting me know that, oh, they happen to see me on this thing. And my life is so saturated with hearing about these cult stories and following them. And so, but still, there are many people who have never seen these shows, don't have any interest, and still to this day have never heard of NXIVM. And so I know that while it is big and it's a lot of exposure, still, it's good to keep it in perspective.
I'm sure there's lots of people, but you are incredible. Rachel, how could people find you?
Right. So they'll just listen for my dogs barking. I think if they follow that song,
you can come find you by the dogs.
Right. Exactly. Oh, that's where Rachel lives. So where they can find me is through my website, rachelbernsteintherapy.com. They can also email me at bernsteinlmft. At gmail.com, and through my podcast, The Indoctrination Show, and indoctrinationshow@gmail.com is a place to email me there, or they can just listen to the show weekly if they want to hear other people talking about their experiences. And then I think also I'm on the advisory board of an organization that I really want people to know about, called the International Cultic Studies Association. And it has great conferences and great materials and articles and resources for attorneys and other people who you might be needing when you're dealing with something like this. There's also something that I started with other colleagues, and I've since moved on from it because I didn't have the time to continue with it, but it's a wonderful program that still exists. It offers 5 free initial consultations with people just coming out of experiences like this. Usually they have no resources. They've given over everything to the cult leader. And it's called Stronger After. You can find it online, stronger_after, and let them know you don't have the funds, if you don't have the funds to seek out counseling, but you want some initial help just to help you land safely back in the world. It's a great place to check out.
Absolutely. And we're going to link all of that on our social media. So check us out on social media. We will link all of these things. Rachel Bernstein, listen to the Indoctrination podcast. Check her out on Starz documentary Seduced, Inside the NXIVM Cult. Rachel, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Amazing.
My pleasure. And thank you for doing this work. I love that you're doing it.
I'm so glad you got to hear this crossover episode with Shrink Chicks, and I hope you enjoyed it. Again, check out their show at any time. It's a great podcast. And now, as promised, we want to give you a little preview of something that we've put together for our Patreon subscribers. And we want to kind of give you a sample of what we're going to be providing weekly. We're going to do check-ins. So I'm going to share my thoughts, about 5 minutes of thoughts, on a variety of different subjects. Something for each person, I hope, something that you're interested in, and something each week. And it's going to be available for every tier and any amount on Patreon. So if you want to be able to get a dose of a little bit more of the show, a couple more of my thoughts and things that I've learned and things that I have kind of accrued over the years that I want to be able to share with you, then go to patreon.com/indoctrination to become a subscriber for any amount, and you're going to be able to hear this on a weekly basis. And so, here's a preview now. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the first weekly check-in. An exclusive little recording, kind of a bite-sized piece of information, musings, sharing of points that I want to be able to talk a little bit more about that are especially for you, the patrons. It's my way and our team's way of saying thank you to you for your support. So today, I want to talk to you about relaxing. It is something that is important to talk about now as we go into the new year. I think it's something to think about for any of you who have trouble with it, because you want to go into the new year being able to take good care of yourself. And one of the ways you do it is by learning to relax. Now, I'm saying this to you knowing I have a problem with it too. I have a private practice and I have kids and I run this podcast and I volunteer and I'm on the boards of different organizations. Oh, and I have dogs. And I've had to learn that sometimes it's okay to sleep in and sometimes it's okay to do nothing. Problem is that for some people growing up in certain kinds of families, sometimes when people are raised in certain environments where you have to keep going and you have to keep working and you can't have, you know, the expression idle hands. What happens when you are raised with that as a value? First of all, you want to understand why that within certain relationships and within certain religious organizations, they want to keep you going because they want you to feel like you're doing something of the utmost importance. And also, if what you're doing is proving to the people who are controlling you that they can control you to the point where, you know, you have blisters on your feet from walking, trying to collect funds for this group, or that you're willing to stay up till all hours of the night just because they told you to, and that makes them feel satisfied, or that they want you to be so busy staying busy that you don't have time to think about if you're happy or not, or if this is actually doing anything for the world or not. You always want to understand the intention of it. Is it for your benefit or for theirs? But I think for some people, when they come out of these kinds of situations, they need to understand that relaxing is incredibly important, not just emotionally, but physiologically. And that if we don't have times where we rest, we will crumble. And by rest, I don't just mean physically rest. Because it doesn't matter if you say, I promise myself that I'm going to lay down for a half an hour today. If your mind is racing, if your heart is racing, if you're thinking I'm being lazy, or God is noticing that I'm lying down, or someone's going to come in and yell at me at any moment for taking some time for myself, then you're not really resting. And you need to find a way to find a safe place to do it, to be around people who will not judge you for it, where you give yourself also permission. And sometimes people find it important to remember that they are as important as the tasks that they produce and they take care of during the day. And if it helps, I have a suggestion. Put your name down on your calendar as an appointment. If you're someone who's busy, if you're someone who is responsible, if you're someone who takes care of things, then take care of you just as you take care of other things. Because unless you do, you won't be able to take care of very many more things for very long. So think about it. Think about putting your name on your calendar for 15 minutes, an hour, a day, a week. and make yourself the appointment. Have a good week. Thanks again for listening. Tired of ads? Well, listen or download this show for free on NPR's Radio Public app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and more. Please support Indoctrination at patreon.com/indoctrination. We have over 100 interviews that you can access with any donation. Subscribers receive bonus interviews and other cool goodies. And we love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. Thank you for your support.
First, there was Tuesday. Then, there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday.
Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego Chicken Sandwich, Fuego Fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego Chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty Classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego Chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.